such as their actual messages to police, had been shared with Facebook. It suggested the data transmission had occurred by accident and that it had installed a tracking tool to help it serve adverts to people who have indicated an interest in a career at the Metropolitan Police. It added, a Metapixel was placed on the Metropolitan Police website in June of 2023 relating to a recruitment marketing campaign, and we're taking steps to remove pixels from any non-recruitment specific pages to avoid unnecessary concern. The use of the pixel by the Metropolitan Police was uncovered during an observer analysis of police websites in England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. The testing last week found 4 police forces using the tool, including the Metropolitan Police. The others were Scottish Police, Norfolk Constabulary and Suffolk Constabulary. Like the Metropolitan Police, Norfolk and Suffolk were found to have shared data about people accessing sensitive web pages. This included when web visitors click links to report antisocial behaviour, domestic abuse, rape, hate crimes and corruption, as well as when they click to view a page titled Tell Us Something Anonymously. In a joint statement, Norfolk and Suffolk Police said they had been using the tracking tool for recruitment purposes. However, recognising the wider implications, we have taken immediate steps to remove the relevant Metapixel, a spokesperson added. Victims, charities and privacy experts said the data sharing was a shocking violation of trust that risks undermining confidence in the police. Dame Vera Bird, the former victims commissioner, said, you think you're dealing with a public authority you can trust, and in fact, you're dealing with Facebook and a wild world of advertising. Mark Richards, an online privacy researcher, said, use of the advertising pixels in this context was like asking someone to report a crime while a stranger is in the room. Professor David Leslie, Director of Ethics at the Alan Turing Institute, said the data sharing seemed reckless and that people appeared to have been given partial or misleading information about how their web browsing data would be used. The expectation of people going onto police sites is that their data is being protected and not shared with any third-party vendors, he said. This just should not be happening. Britain's data privacy watchdog, the Information Commissioner's Office, said the findings raised real privacy concerns. These websites are aimed at victims and witnesses of crimes, who would expect their information to be handled with particular care, it said. It is already investigating the use of the Metapixel in the websites of the National Health Service Trust and said it would consider the latest evidence. Metapixel, a free tool offered by Facebook, is widely used by businesses that want to reach people who have visited their websites in future marketing campaigns. The tool, which collects information about people who have Facebook accounts, as well as those who do not, is pitched by Facebook as a way for organizations to get rich insights into website performance and user behavior. Facebook's parent company, Meta, also uses the data sent to it by the Pixel for its own business purposes, including improving the targeted advertising products it offers to other customers. In one guide, the company explains that it uses data collected by the Pixel to improve users' experiences, for example, by sharing them with adverts that they might be interested in. You may see adverts for hotel deals if you visit travel websites, it says. While the Metapixel collects details of unique identifiers such as those of a person's IP address and Facebook profile ID, There is no suggestion that the company has attempted to identify people as victims of crime or to target them with advertisements based on their victim or witness status. There is also no suggestion that information shared with the company includes details of interactions with police beyond buttons clicked and web pages viewed on the police website. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Metropolitan Police Force has 161 serving officers with criminal convictions in its ranks. Britain's biggest police force, the Metropolitan Police Force, has 161 officers with criminal convictions in its ranks, including three officers who carried out sexual offences while employed. Scotland Yard's Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, made the revelation in a letter to the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, and the Mayor of London. It comes after the Metropolitan Police Force was branded institutionally racist, sexist, and homophobic in a major review which was commissioned after 33-year-old Sarah Everard was murdered by a serving police officer, Wayne Cousins. The Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, said, "It was crucial that the public had confidence in the Metropolitan Police to keep Londoners safe. I have been clear that a relentless focus on improving standards and common sense policing is required," she added. Scotland Yard's Commissioner Sir Mark Rowley's update on the work to root out unfit officers demonstrates the scale of this challenge. But I have confidence in his plan to turn around the Metropolitan Police and ensure the force is delivering for the public. I am also driving forward work to review the police dismissals process to ensure the system is effective at removing officers who fall below the standards that we expect. The chairman of the London Assembly Police and Crime Committee, Susan Hall, said it was concerning that so many serving police officers had criminal convictions, but she trusted the Metropolitan Police to robustly review their cases. It is promising to see that the Commissioner is determined to deliver on more suspensions, more hearings, and more dismissals of those who simply should not be police officers, she added. Susan Hall added, "To achieve this, the Commissioner needs clearer rules which give him greater power to remove police officers who are proven unfit for the role, as we recommend in our report looking at police complaint system last year."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a 2024 military spending following heated debates between Republicans and the Democrats in the lower chamber of Congress. The bill, also known as Fiscal 2024 National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, sets policy for the Pentagon, and authorizes record $886 billion in spending. The motion was approved 2019-2010, not from the typical bipartisan support for the bill, but through party lines. The measure includes a pay raise for members of the military, initiatives to counter China, and an additional $300 million to support Ukraine. The Republicans also added a number of amendments to the bill. But the Democrats said they would not support the NDAA after the Republican majority House voted for the amendments on hot-button social issues pushed by the party's hard-right flank. That includes an amendment that would reverse the Defense Department policy of reimbursing expenses for service members who travel to obtain an abortion.
Now, I have voted for the NDAA every year that I have served in Congress, but I cannot in good conscience vote for this legislation in its current form.
The Pentagon travel reimbursement policy is aimed at helping those in the military or family members who are seeking an abortion but stationed in states that have outlawed it. Representative Adam Smith, the senior Democrat on the House Services Committee, warned that Americans are going to have fewer qualified people willing to join the military because of what was passed. Republicans, however, hailed the passage of the bill and the amendments. Republican Representative Barry Loudermilk said House Republicans today passed an NDAA that increases our military's lethality and decreases the wokeness that has been infused in its ranks in recent years. The House Republicans were able to pass their amendments without Democratic support, but such provision would die in the Senate, where President Biden's fellow Democrats hold a 59-49 majority. The debate in that chamber is set to begin on Tuesday. The passage of the NDAA comes as the Senate is expected to pass its version of the act later this month, after which two chambers will negotiate a compromise that would come up for a vote later this year. The NDAA, one of the only major pieces of legislation Congress passes annually, is closely watched by a broad swathe of industry and other interests because it determines everything from purchases of ships and aircrafts to pay increases for soldiers and how to address geopolitical threats. The record military spending comes as, according to figures, the U.S. spends more on defense than the next 10 countries combined. While China, Russia, India, Saudi Arabia, United Kingdom, Germany, France, South Korea, Japan, and Ukraine spend more than $800 billion altogether, the U.S. alone spends $886. In the meantime, the U.S. has historically devoted a large share of its economy to defense than many of its allies. From 1977 to 2022, the U.S. defense spending out of the country's GDP fluctuated between 3-7% compared to that of UK, France, Italy, Germany, Canada, and Japan. The passage of the bill by the House comes as the United States has much vital issues to address, at least domestically. According to figures released by Peter G. Peterson Foundation, the United States is lagging way behind other wealthy nations in terms of health care. Figures by the foundation say U.S. per capita healthcare spending is over twice the average of other wealthy nations, including Italy, Japan, the U.K., Ireland, and Canada. At the same time, and according to figures by the same foundation, the U.S. national debt stood at over $31 trillion at the end of 2022. Of that amount, about $24 trillion, or 78%, was debt held by the public representing cash borrowed from domestic and foreign investors. The federal government's borrowed that money, but the one who has to pay it back is the American public. Still, regardless of those facts, the United States continues to arm countries already at war with other nations, including Ukraine. Washington has left no stone unturned to provide military aid packages to Kiev worth tens of billions of dollars and continues to do so. Taiwan is also another destination for U.S. weapons worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The U.S. also moves on with its military buildups in the South China Sea and on the Korean Peninsula, which have literally brought nothing for the Americans but fear of an all-out escalation. All in all, what seems to be of high significance for U.S. authorities is to come to the understanding that they need to stop spending the U.S. taxpayers' money for deadly wars and instead address issues Americans are grappling with, including health care.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has concluded a tour of Africa. During his trip, President Raisi visited Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. In the Kenyan capital of Nairobi, President Raisi oversaw, along with his Kenyan counterpart, William Ruto, the signing of 5 memoranda of understanding. Raisi said that Iran is ready to cooperate with Kenya in the fields of petrochemicals, agriculture, science, technology, medicines, and medical equipment, as well as the fishery industry and the fight against narcotics. The Iranian chief executive also described his trip as a turning point in bilateral relations, noting that it can create a good market for Iranian products in Kenya and in East Africa. He further emphasized that the ties between Iran and Kenya would not be limited to their borders.
We have historic cooperation with the African continent and Kenya, and believe that relations between the governments and people of Iran and Kenya can expand further. Our goal is to expand cooperation by tenfold.
It is a special privilege to host President Raisi in Nairobi, and his presence is testimony to the strong ties between Kenya and Iran. It is also a demonstration of our shared commitment to cooperate for the benefit of the people of our two countries.
In Uganda, President Raisi called for expanding and strengthening relations with Uganda in various fields. Raisi, accompanied by a high-ranking delegation, was officially received by the Ugandan President Museveni at his presidential palace in Kampala. President Raisi called for the development of closer economic ties between the nations and noted that friendly countries need to work together to develop raw materials into value-added products. Two sides also inked 4 cooperation documents. President Raisi visited Zimbabwe in the last leg of his African tour. Raisi said Iran and Zimbabwe have great capacities that can be used in the promotion and development of relations and cooperation between the two countries. The two countries signed a number of MOUs to boost trade. In March, Raisi hosted a meeting with a group of representatives from West Africa, in which he pitched Iran as a different kind of partner when compared with countries in the West with colonial histories in the continent. The trip comes a month after Raisi embarked on a tour of Latin America, where he signed a host of agreements to boost ties with fellow U.S. sanctioned allies Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua.
Iran's view on Africa is quite different from that of neocolonialism or its older version. We seek to transfer technology to Africa and empower the continent. African leaders and their people are now quite sensitive on protecting their independence. This is among commonalities between Iran and African nations. Another issue of equal importance for Iran and Africa is the U.S. sanctions regime. With Africa's assistance, we should prevent the U.S. and certain states that still have a colonial mindset from utilizing the deadly tool of sanctions against nations.
President Raisi's trip to Africa is the first such visit to the continent in 11 years. His visit is primarily aimed at boosting Iran's foreign trade in a region with an economy of $600 billion. Iran exported $1.2 billion worth of goods and services, including petrochemical products, food, medicine, and engineering and technical services to Africa last year. The amount was still not high enough, despite it being an improvement on recent years. Iran, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, embarked on renewing relations with the African people based on Islam's prohibition of racism. The policy of strengthening relations with Africa continued during the terms of the next Iranian president, who paid 41 visits to Africa in total. Trade between Iran and Africa increased between 2005 and 2006, but the global financial crisis and cruel sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic under UN Security Council resolution in 2007 decimated it. Iran expects trade with Africa to hit $10 billion in the next 3 years. Africa is home to 18% of the world's population. With an increasing population growth, it sits on some 30% of the world's mineral reserves, 65% of the world's arable land, and 10% of the planet's freshwater source. It is rich in natural resources, with abundant arable land, water, oil, natural gas, minerals, forests, and wildlife. Experts believe the global economy requires Iran to interact with any opportunities on an international scale and to improve its foreign currency incomes.
North Korea has accused the U.S. military of conducting provocative surveillance flights which violate its airspace and trespass in its exclusive economic zone. Pyongyang warned Washington that if such provocations persist, American reconnaissance planes may be shot down. This comes amid soaring tensions on the Korean Peninsula, largely as a result of massive joint U.S.-South Korean war games, which have seen the White House deploy aircraft carriers, nuclear-capable bombers, and Reaper drones. Kim Yo-jong, the sister of the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, as well as one of his top foreign policy officials, said North Korean warplanes scrambled to intercept a U.S. spy plane flying in Pyongyang's exclusive economic zone, where it controls natural resources. This includes the area within 200 nautical miles of its territory. She insisted there were 8 such intrusions on Monday, denouncing the intensifying stories by the American aircraft as encroaching on her country's sovereignty. Kim issued a warning that U.S. forces would experience a very critical fight if these aggressive actions continue. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff denied Washington was flying spy planes into North Korean territory, with a spokesman explaining the U.S. is instead in the area surrounding the peninsula conducting standard reconnaissance activities. In response, Kim fired back that the Joint Chiefs of Staff was acting as if they were the Pentagon's spokesperson. An earlier statement by North Korea's defense ministry stated that the U.S. was flying its reconnaissance planes within the country's inviolable airspace, which extends 12 nautical miles from the coast per international law. The ministry also charged the U.S. actions were raising the risk of nuclear conflict on the peninsula, pointing to the White House's pledge that the Washington will periodically dock nuclear-armed ballistic missile submarines in South Korea, while also citing the ongoing presence of American spy planes and drones. The statement alerted, "There is no guarantee that such a shocking accident as the downing of the U.S. Air Force strategic reconnaissance plane will not happen." North Korean media described the U.S. sending nuclear assets to the peninsula as the most undisguised nuclear blackmail against Pyongyang as well as its neighbors. Last month, an American B-52 strategic bomber participated in joint air military drills with Seoul. After a multi-year pause, U.S. President Joe Biden's administration resumed large-scale war games targeting the North Korea. Consequently, since 2022, Pyongyang has launched more than 100 missiles. As part of the giant joint military exercises this year, Washington and Seoul more recently carried out the largest war drills in the history of their 7-decade alliance. Some of these drills have even taken place near the border with the demilitarized zone. The North has maintained that its weapons and nuclear programs are essential deterrent measures in the face of persisting war games carried out near its waters by U.S. and South Korean military forces, which it regards as rehearsals to invade the country. Meanwhile, in a separate report released by North Korea's Foreign Ministry, Pyongyang accused Washington of making desperate efforts to ignite a nuclear war and blamed the U.S. for sending strategic assets to the region. The so-called denuclearization talks that got underway after a high-profile summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump has stalled since 2019 over persisting U.S.-led sanctions against the North and Washington's refusal to reciprocate Pyongyang's denuclearization bid. The Biden administration has recently deployed a nuclear-armed warship to South Korea, further inciting the North to continue and expand its nuclear weapons program. Last year, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea entered a trilateral defense agreement. At the time, North Korea referred to this pact as an Asian version of NATO. In June, it was revealed that the U.S. intelligence community has concluded Pyongyang will continue to use its nuclear weapons status only as a way of coercively accomplishing some political and diplomatic objectives, not for offensive military purposes. Compared with Donald Trump, President Joe Biden has taken a vastly more bellicose policy regarding North Korea. In the last half of the Trump administration, war games were rolled back, dialogue was opened, and all sides reduced weapons tests. As crippling sanctions are imposed indefinitely, Biden has offered Pyongyang no off-ramp. The administration is demanding Kim agree to his country's denuclearization and disarmament. The current status quo has North Korea facing myriad regime change rehearsals on its doorstep, while U.S. officials periodically threaten the country with obliteration.
Crossing a new threshold in the type of weaponry supplied to Kiev, The United States on Friday announced it will provide the internationally banned cluster munitions to Ukraine.
In this environment, Ukraine has been requesting cluster munitions in order to defend its own sovereign territory. The cluster munitions that we would provide have dud rates far below what Russia is doing, is providing, not higher than 2.5%.
Sullivan said Ukraine would not be using the munitions in a foreign land. He added that Kiev has provided assurances in writing that the weapons will be used carefully to minimize risks to civilian lives. U.S. President Joe Biden defended the decision, saying it was because the efforts to defend against Russia had run out of ammunition. The move drew an instant reaction from the United Nations.
The Secretary General supports the Convention on Cluster Munitions, which, as you know, was adopted 15 years ago. And he wants countries to abide by the terms of that convention. And so as a result, of course, he does not want there to be continued use of cluster munitions on the battlefield.
A number of key U.S. allies defied Washington's decision to supply cluster munitions to Kiev.
Well, the UK is signatory to a convention which prohibits the production or use of cluster munitions and discourages their use. We will continue to do our part to support Ukraine against Russia's illegal and unprovoked invasion.
Sunak made the comments in an address to reporters. Spain also followed suit, saying that certain weapons and bombs cannot be delivered under any circumstances. France reiterated its opposition to the use of the controversial weapon. Germany said the decision goes against the Convention of Cluster Munitions that bans such weapons on the battlefield. Neither the United States nor Ukraine is party to the pact. Russia strongly condemned the move. In a statement, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said it is an act of desperation and shows weakness against the backdrop of the failure of the much-touted Ukrainian counteroffensive. Zakharova added the decision showed the aggressive anti-Russian course taken by the U.S., which is aimed at prolonging the conflict in Ukraine as much as possible. Tehran also lambasted the move. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the U.S. decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine shows Washington's determination to perpetuate and further complicate the war in Ukraine. Inside the U.S., congressional Democrats raised concerns over the move. Senators Barbara Lee and Tim Kaine said Washington's decision to set cluster bombs to Ukraine could inspire other countries to sidestep an international convention barring such munitions. Supplying Kiev with cluster munitions comes as the armaments are highly controversial weapons that typically release large number of smaller bomblets, which can kill indiscriminately over a wide area. Those that go undetonated potentially endanger civilians for years to come. Cluster munitions are banned by over 100 countries. The supply of such weapons bring Washington's total aid to Ukraine to more than $40 billion since the Ukraine war began in February 2022. In total, the United States and its allies have provided Ukraine with numerous military aid packages worth hundreds of billions of dollars. The military support for Ukraine includes the delivery of heavy and light military weapons and ammunition, as well as non-lethal material military aid. Those weapons are sent to Kiev regardless of the fact that Russia has time and again warned that such a trend would only prolong the conflict and cause more destruction on both sides. But Ukraine allies seem to be more concerned about Kiev's failure on the battlefield and have consequently kept pumping Kiev full of advanced weapons. Those weapons not only have failed to prevent the conflict from getting exacerbated, but instead they have led to even more escalation on both sides. With Ukraine's so-called counteroffensive now it's in second months, Kiev has announced gains during its attacks on Russian forces. Ukraine says a number of villages have been liberated thanks to its counteroffensive. Russia, in the meantime, has targeted positions belonging to Ukraine using missiles, causing death and destruction in several areas. All in all, by supplying Ukraine with the internationally banned cluster munitions, the United States is taking two huge risks. One is simply prolonging the war, as Russia has numerously reiterated. And two is possibly getting Washington involved in the conflict. And that's what many throughout the globe prefer not to pick, given its potential global catastrophic consequences.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The Economic Activity of Public Bodies Bill, which opposes boycotts of the Israeli regime, was introduced in the British Parliament, the House of Commons, recently, sparking a massive outcry. The legislation seeks to bar public organisations in Britain from boycotting the Israeli regime through sanctions and divestment campaigns. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. The website of Arab News has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's second largest trade union has declared its support for the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS movement against the Israeli regime, slamming the British government legislation barring institutions from boycotting products made in the occupied Palestinian territories. Unite, which represents 1.2 million British workers and is one of 15 trade unions affiliated to the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, passed three motions supporting the boycott, divestments and sanctions regime at its conference on Friday, 14th of July, demanding that the British government abandon the Economic Activity and Public Bodies legislation that bans public bodies from launching their own boycott efforts, explicitly mentioning the Israeli regime and the occupied Palestinian territories. The relevant motion said the bill seeks to limit the ability of public bodies to make ethical choices about spending and investment that reflect widespread public support for human rights, climate goals and international law. The motion further pointed to Unite's support for boycotts, divestments and sanctions campaign against companies with ties to the Israeli regime and the occupied Palestinian territories. At the conference, the union also pledged to promote the right to boycott campaign among its membership, urging workers to sign a petition against the British government's bill. The PCS director, Ben Jamal, declared, "At the moment, when the government's anti-boycott bill seeks to delegitimize the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment and sanctions, the unanimous support of Unite's members for motions affirming support for boycott, divestment and sanctions is crucial. Unite has made clear that it will continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Palestinian people and reject all efforts to delegitimize their struggle for liberation." The Palestine Solidarity Campaign also pointed out that the bill would further shield companies engaged in human rights abuse or environmental destruction by preventing public bodies from cutting their financial ties with them over abusive or illegal actions. Another motion passed during the conference confirmed the union's recognition of the Israeli regime as practicing apartheid and demanded from the British government to abandon its free trade agreement with the occupying Israeli regime. The last motion passed in the conference concerned the Israeli military's labeling of six Palestinian civil society and human rights organizations as terrorist bodies, clarifying that the targeted organizations provide services and support to women, children, farmers and prisoners, and collectively support thousands of Palestinians. The conference emphasized this in a direct assault on an effort to isolate and restrict human rights defenders. UNITE called on the British government to reiterate its support for the Palestinian civil society and for the Israeli regime to retract its spurious claims. The boycotts, divestments and sanctions movement, which is modelled after the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, was initiated in 2005 by over 170 Palestinian organizations and were pushing for various forms of boycott against the Israeli regime until it meets its obligations under international law. Thousands of volunteers worldwide have since then joined the boycotts, divestments and sanctions movement, which calls for people and groups across the world to cut their economic, cultural and economic ties to Tel Aviv to help promote the Palestinian cause. British newspaper The Telegraph has also covered the same story and tells us more. Britain's parliament is considering a government bill that would bar local councils from boycotting Israeli goods, drawing outrage from civil society organisations in Britain. The bill would prevent local councils and universities from adopting their own foreign policy by boycotting Israel or companies that trade with Tel Aviv. UK Community Secretary Michael Gove proposed the legislation to the British Parliament, the House of Commons, recently. Michael Gove told The Telegraph, "It is simply wrong that public bodies that have been wasting taxpayers' time and money pursuing their own foreign policy agenda." He added, "The United Kingdom must have a consistent approach to foreign policy set by the British government." Michael Gove accused anti-Israeli campaigns of undermining Britain's foreign policy. The legislation would enable ministers to conduct investigations into suspected breach of the ban. The Telegraph said public bodies that break the new rule could be significantly fined. Observers believe the legislation would be a direct assault on the Palestinian civil society movement, boycott, divestment and sanctions regime. Former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said boycott, divestment and sanctions will be essential for ending apartheid by the Israeli regime, just as they helped end apartheid in South Africa. Jeremy Corbyn, who sits in the House of Commons as an independent, tweeted recently, "I will firmly oppose the government's anti-boycott, divestment and sanctions bill, a disgraceful attack on our freedom to fight for human rights, justice and peace throughout the world." Over 60 civil society organisations, including Greenpeace UK and Liberty, have warned in a letter that the bill represents an attack on freedom of expression in Britain. They said, if passed, this law will stifle a wide range of campaigns concerned with the arms race. The website of Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. Ben Jamal, the director of the London-based Palestine Solidarity Campaign, has already said that with support growing around the world for boycotts, divestment and sanctions, the British government seems determined to shield the Israeli regime and companies involved in its occupation from accountability for its violations of human rights and international laws. Ruth Ehrlich, head of policy and campaign at Liberty, said, The proposed anti-boycott bill once again shows that the British government's flimsy commitment to protecting freedom of expression. Ruth Ehrlich said they're considering the bill by the government as in fact attempting to curb our rights to protect and for people to stand up to what they believe in. She added, the bill sets an extremely dangerous precedent and its potential impact is harmful and wide-ranging. We urge the government to rethink its plans. Rani Ahmadi, legal advisor to the United Nations at the European Union, who previously served as the United Nations legal advocacy representing Badil, the Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights, said British government's move to table a bill in the parliament that intends to ban local public bodies from joining the popular boycott campaign against the Israeli regime threatens to erode democratic values, restrict freedom of expression, and undermine campaigns for social justice in Britain. The Ramallah West Bank-born activist and attorney remarked, "We, the Palestinian lawyers, activists from all over the world and civil society, are deeply concerned by the government's anti-boycott bill, which threatens to erode local democracy, restrict freedom of expression under Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and undermine campaigns for social and climate justice."
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. The U.S. intelligence community has stated on numerous occasions that Iran isn't pursuing nuclear weapons. Just a few months ago, in two instances, they admitted that there are no signs that Iran is moving toward the construction of nuclear weapons. They're right. Of course, it isn't that we are afraid of them or that it is because of them that we don't pursue nuclear weapons. We believe that nuclear weapons are used for mass destruction. We are against mass destruction. It is contradictory to religion, and it is contradictory to Islam. And it doesn't matter whether it is using atomic, chemical, or any other possible type of weaponry. In the wars that were fought during the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, Imam Ali and the early days of Islam, instructions were given to be careful not to block people's access to water. At that time, the common practice against the general public was to block access to water. There wasn't chemical welfare or things of that sort.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Based on our Islamic principle, we do not wish to pursue such weapons. Otherwise, if it weren't for our belief, and if we had wished to pursue these, they wouldn't have been able to stop us. In the same way that they haven't been able to stop our nuclear development up until now, and they won't be able to do so in the future. If we had wanted to build nuclear weapons, we would have done so. They, too, know this. So this excuse about nuclear weapons is a lie. That is not the issue. The issue is something else. They know that advancement in the nuclear industry is actually the key to making significant progress in many fields in the country. They don't want that to happen. They don't want us to make significant, inspiring progress in various fields. Whatever progress the Iranian nation makes, the Iranian nation's mindset, the Iranian nation's path of action, and the Iranian nation's democracy will affect other nations. They don't want this. They are afraid of this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Federation of Trade Unions says British workers have suffered a double whammy of high inflation and historically poor wage growth. The Federation of Trade Unions says ministers must stop scapegoating workers and come up with a credible plan to lift living standards and boost economic growth. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. The UK fiscal watchdog warned that Britain's public finances are in a very risky period after a series of shocks left it in a vulnerable position to tackle an ageing population. The Office for Budget Responsibility, the OBR, suggested that unsustainable debt levels meant the government was facing further tax rises or significant cuts to spending. The watchdog, the Office for Budget Responsibility, said Britain's state finances have been badly shaken by a triple shock from the COVID pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and the cost of living crisis, causing public debt to balloon. The government's debt pile grew to more than 100% of annual gross domestic product in May, for the first time since 1961. And the Office of Budget Responsibility, OBR, said public debt could surge to more than 300% of economic output by the 2070s. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's government has committed to bringing debt down as one of its five pledges. And a watchdog has said this debt is set to decline by 2027-2028 as a result. The Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, said higher interest rates and inflation could put pressure on efforts to reduce this debt, but did not alter its previous forecast from March, which showed the government would meet this fiscal pledge. However, the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, has cautioned that pressures from the ageing population, climate change and geopolitical issues are likely to reverse this trend dramatically in the longer term. The chairman of the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, Richard Hughes, said, "It is clear that current policy settings aren't sustainable, left where they are, raising the prospect of further tax rises or spending cuts by the end of the decade." In response, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said this highlights why it is important to deliver on the Prime Minister's priority to get debt falling and to control borrowing to avoid adding inflationary pressures and risk prolonging higher inflation. Jeremy Hunt added, "That means taking difficult decisions but responsible decisions under public finances, including public sector pay, because more borrowing is itself inflationary." Meanwhile, the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, said, "This report shows just how far we are falling behind our peers, how exposed our economy is, and again highlights that the government is failing to take action in areas like energy security to help get bills down." Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, said, "It tells you all you need to know that the cost of government borrowing has risen faster in the United Kingdom than elsewhere in the G7 group, and faster than at any time in the last 40 years. The Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, also said that long-term sickness will cost the state a further £6.8 billion this year, as the number of Britons unable to work due to illness has surged after the pandemic. The forecaster said there was a 440,000 increase in those unable to work and a 490,000 rise in workers with ill health but in work claiming health-related benefits. The Office for Budget Responsibility added, "While the disruption to and difficulties in accessing National Health Service services may have played a role in the worsening physical and mental health of the working age population during this period, tackling the NHS waiting list alone is likely to make only a modest difference in terms of the number of people out of work." Chris Thomas, head of the Institute for Public Policy Research, the think tank's Commission on Health and Prosperity, said the recognition that higher sickness levels are a fiscal risk is a watershed moment for the economy. Chris Thomas added, "Today, the Office for Budget Responsibility has concluded that better health is one of the clearest paths to prosperity in the United Kingdom, but that through a decade of austerity, a global pandemic, and a National Health Service crisis, the United Kingdom is off track and well behind other comparable countries." Chris Thomas added, "On the same day, the National Health Service waiting lists have hit new highs, and the National Health Service in England has admitted it may not meet the Prime Minister's pledge to reduce these before the next election." Russia's Sputnik news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Junior doctors in the United Kingdom staged a 5-day walkout over pay and working conditions, the biggest industrial action in the history of the country's state-funded National Health Service, the NHS. The unprecedented strike by members of the British Medical Association, BMA, began at 7 a.m. local time on Thursday, 13th of July, and will last until 7 a.m. on Tuesday, 18th of July. Aryan Singh, a 27-year-old junior doctor on a picket line outside London's University College Hospital, said, UK officials claim that the National Health Service has been running on goodwill, and now we say this is the last chance to change that, adding that colleagues were planning to leave for countries that care about their doctors. Aryan Singh added, doctors have realised they work in a global market and they're not restricted to this country. The British Medical Association leaders, Robert Lawrenson and Vivek Trivedi, had said, ahead of the walkout, today marks the start of the longest single walkout by doctors in the National Health Service's history, but this is still not a record that needs to go into the history books. They went on to say that the strike could be called off if the British government will simply follow the example of the government in Scotland and drop their nonsensical precondition of not talking while strikes are announced and produce an offer which is credible to the doctors that they're speaking with.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Is GDP a real indicator of economic growth of a given nation? Many economists agree that although the measure is a rough and ready instrument to assess the size of economy of a given country, it is not designed to estimate welfare or the well-being of its citizens. However, most governments resort to broadcasting their growing GDP to reassure domestic and international markets. Italy's current executive makes no exception. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has, on several occasions, stressed that GDP growth is a measure of success for her predecessor Mario Draghi and her government.
Our capacity for post-pandemic recovery is therefore all to see. Today, the Italian economy is growing beyond expectations, with an upward forecast estimate of GDP of more than 1.2% in 2023.
Based on the final data for 2022 and using the 2023 projections from the latest OECD economic outlook, Italy is expected to achieve the strongest economic growth among G7 countries in the 2023 period, with a 5% increase in GDP over 2 years. The situation on the ground is very much different. Inflation in Italy has risen remarkably from mid-2021, passing the 12% mark last year. Over one in four people in the country were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2022, according to a latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat. Furthermore, just under 25% of Italians between the ages of 15 and 29 are at risk of becoming poor, compared to an EU average of around 20%.
As for Italy's crisis, wealth distribution in the country has never been so uneven, with an increasing number of workers practically falling into a state of slavery. The decision by the ECB to raise interest rates to counter high inflation has only aggravated the situation. This way, the payments on variable rate mortgages have practically doubled for a large number of Italian households.
Also, data by charity Oxfam shows the concentration of wealth in Italy has considerably increased by the end of 2021. The wealth of the richest 5% of Italians, owner of